Okay, so in this last talk, I want, first of all, to go back to the beginning. I want to go back to the beginning of the Udana, back to the Buddha's enlightenment. We're going to go back, in fact, to Sutta number 4 in the Bodhi section. And this time the Buddha is seated beneath the goat herd's banyan tree. Banyans are really big, wonderful trees. They're often planted on the sides of country roads, and they're huge, and they're of these branches with roots that go down from the branches and plant themselves, so then they grow even more trees. Fabulous trees, love banyans. Anyway, the Buddha's under the goat herd's banyan tree, and once again the Buddha is shown having realized full enlightenment. And he is sitting for 7 days, cross-legged, enjoying the bliss of liberation. So it's another period of deep absorption. And after those 7 days, the Buddha emerges from his samadhi. And after emerging from samadhi, from the depths of meditation, somebody comes along. Perhaps news had got around to the nearby villages that there was a holy man staying in the forest, and someone was curious. In fact, that person was a certain haughty Brahmin. A haughty, conceited Brahmin. The Pali says that it was a Brahmin who went around going, humph, 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 which was an expression of his pride. Some scholars think it might be a mantra he was using, it's not clear, but he was a haughty Brahmin, prone to conceit, looking down his nose at others. And this Brahmin approached the Buddha, sitting there beneath the goat herd's banyan tree. And the haughty Brahmin asked the Buddha, how is someone a Brahmin? What makes someone a Brahmin? It's a strange question from a Brahmin, a trick question, really. Because the haughty Brahmin would have known very well what makes someone a Brahmin. What makes someone a Brahmin is whether they've been born into a Brahmin family. That's what makes them a part of the Brahmin caste. You're born into it. That's the only way that you can become a Brahmin. And the Buddha's response to this question is immediate. He immediately utters an Udana. There's something about the question, something about the questioner that really stirs him, really moves him. Perhaps it's a bit like that situation you can sometimes find yourself in when someone is playing a sort of game with you, not taking you seriously and trying to sort of trick you and manipulate you in some way. And you don't get angry, but you suddenly find yourself speaking the truth from the depths, completely changing the situation. Perhaps it was a bit like that. And the Buddha said, a Brahmin is one who has discarded evil states. He's not haughty, free from stains and self-controlled, perfect in knowledge, one who has lived the holy life. He might rightly use the word Brahma, who has no swellings anywhere in the world. And once again, we see the Buddha attempting, and in the end it was an attempt that sort of failed, but attempting to redefine what a Brahmin, the highest man, according to that society, according to Brahmins, is. Who is the holy man in society? He's saying that the highest holy man is the enlightened individual. The man who's discarded evil, unskillful states, who's without conceit, not haughty, not like you. That's the implication. Such a man is without stain. Bhante said that this is a really old, ancient conception of an enlightened man, somebody without any stains, completely pure. They're self-controlled, tamed. He's tamed himself, mastered himself. He has perfect knowledge. He sees things as they really are. He has really lived the holy life, the Dharma life. So for him, there are no swellings anywhere in the world. Interesting expression, swellings. The word in Pali is usada, and an older translation has moral warts. Moral warts, sort of negative growths of sort of lust and hate and delusion and conceit and false views, excrescences. It's as if they're describing sort of unskillful negative conditioning as being like sort of fungal growths. The enlightened man has sort of burned them off, got rid of all that, and there's just this, you know, pure consciousness, if you like. Such a man is the enlightened man, the true Brahmin. It's highly significant that according to the Udana, the Buddha's first meeting after enlightenment is with someone who is from the Brahmin caste, and that the encounter involves a critique of traditional Brahmins. A critique, the implication is in fact a critique of caste, a critique of a society made up of caste. It's this hugely significant. The Buddha's Udana is making it abundantly clear that the worth and value of a man has nothing to do with his birth, nothing to do with his caste. A man's worth and value derives from his moral and spiritual quality. So right at the very origins of the Buddhist tradition, the very origins of Buddhism, we have social critique. In a sense, we have social revolution. The Buddha's enlightenment was not just about his own individual spiritual liberation. That individual liberation had an immediate impact on the imprisoning structures of Indian society. The structures that see a human being not as a human being, but as belonging to a particular caste. Or whether or not they are a man or a woman, or whether or not they are in good working order, so to speak. And throughout the Udana, you see the Buddha communicating the Dharma to people who would have been regarded as outcast or completely unsuited to living the Dhamma life, even regarded as unsuited to living a truly human life. Page 66 of John Ireland's translation has the story of Supa Buddha, the leper. So he's definitely an outcast, a leper. And he sees a crowd and he thinks, food. I'll go to that crowd. There'll be food there. But the crowd is there to hear the Dhamma. And the Buddha looks round this crowd of people, seeing who will really get the teaching. And he notices this leper. And he knows that this man will get the teaching and directs his Dhamma discourse to this leper, who gets it and becomes enlightened. Page 94 of John Ireland's translation, there's a few suttas around this part of the, in chapter 7. There's Buddhya the dwarf, a very, very highly developed individual, but a dwarf. And Buddhya is actually despised, sadly, even by his fellow bhikkhus. He's become a bhikkhu through hearing the Dharma taught by the Buddha. And he's despised even by the bhikkhus because he's ugly, unsightly, deformed. The Buddha just sees his spiritual quality. And he says to the Buddha, says to his disciples, the monks, Buddhya is great in supernormal potency and power. He is a man of great attainment, an arahant. Also in section 7, sutta 10, the harem of King Udena has burned down, and 500 women in the harem had died. And the Buddha tells the bhikkhus hearing this that some of these women, in the harem of King Udena, some of them are stream entrants, some of them are once returners, some of them are non-returners, and some of them are arahants. They're all disciples of the Buddha, which has sort of all gone on in secret. I mean, these women would have been regarded as, you know, any kind of spiritual life wouldn't have been available to them. There's a lovely backstory to this from the commentaries, that these women had led by the I think the main queen or the main wife, not quite sure how these things work, was a disciple of the Buddha and had heard the Dharma, but they were forbidden from hearing any more Dharma. The king was, you know, quite bothered about that. So they sent their servant girl out every day into the town to hear the Buddha teaching. The servant girl, who of course would have been low caste, came back. They set up a throne for her and she just taught what she'd heard of the Buddha. And in this way, they all developed along the path. Fantastic story. So the point I'm making here, the Buddha talks, communicates the Dharma to anybody. He doesn't see things in terms of artificial, socially imposed, even religiously imposed categories. And not that people from Brahmin or other so-called higher castes were excluded either. The point is, all that the Buddha is interested in is the individual man and woman. All he is interested in is their humanness and the development of their humanness to the point even of enlightenment. And he created a sangha, a community of individuals characterized by the quality of being unified through that humanness. That humanness can be developed to the highest possible level. In fact, the quality of humanness comes from having the highest human ideal. And we heard yesterday the Buddha saying that just as the rivers of the world lose their names when they flow into the great and mighty ocean, just so when people enter the Sangha, which means in our terms when they go for refuge, they lose their caste names, they lose their caste identities. They are known just as sons and daughters of the Buddha. So the Buddha's communication of the Dharma had this very strong social revolutionary aspect. And it's one of the reasons why Dr. Ambedkar, Babasaheb Ambedkar, and his followers went for refuge to the Buddha. Because they realised that, particularly Dr. Ambedkar realised that individuals practising the Buddha Dharma would bring about a real and lasting revolution in Indian society. Because the Buddha Dharma enables people to see through the constructions of caste and the enslavement of caste, and especially the hell of untouchability. It enables people to see the real humanness in one another. I'm deliberately using this word humanness, this sort of coinage, if you like. It's a translation, the best we can do, of a really wonderful word in Marathi that Dr. Ambedkar would use, which is manuski. Manuski. It's a very, very strong word in Marathi. Seeing people without the taint and stain of caste or any other artificial construction. It's sort of manness, humanness. And it's also clear from looking at the Udana just how active the Buddha and his early disciples were. We tend to think of the Buddha and his disciples as spending all their time meditating and talking Dhamma in the forest, and there certainly would have been plenty of that. But the Buddha and his disciples gave a lot of time to being with people. The Buddha spent a lot of his time living near the great cities, walking on tour through the villages, going to the market towns, meeting all kinds of people, wandering, freelance sort of religieux, if you like, of different traditions, kings and queens, cowherds, businessmen, courtesans, beggars, lepers, you name it, even yakas, sort of powerful nature spirits, devas, whoever it was, getting into meaningful human Dhamma communication with them. Not only the Buddha did this, but his great disciples as well. One of my favourite suttas in the Udana is again in chapter 1, the Bodhi chapter. It's the sixth sutta. And this sutta is about Mahakasapa, one of the great arahants. The scene is Rajagaha, the great capital of Magadha. It's near the Vulture's Peak, and Mahakasapa is staying in the famous Pippali Cave. And he's very, very ill indeed. He's sick, afflicted, grievously ill. But he recovers somehow from his sickness, although presumably he's still weak, and he decides that it's time to enter the great city of Rajagaha to beg for his food. And then immediately, 500 devatas, 500 gods, began to gather round and prepare food for him, presumably devic food of some kind, ambrosia. But Mahakasapa rejects their attentions. He rejects the food of the devas. He rejects that delicious ambrosia. Instead, he donned his robe, took up his bowl, and went to Rajagaha to beg. And he went especially to the poorest part of the great city. He went to the weaver's quarter. And the weavers, of course, are low caste, even outcast. He went there to beg his food. And you know, we can be sure the food would not be of the quality of the devas in that part of town. When people in the West read this sutta, they wonder what's going on. Taking these poor people's food, you know, when he could have had the food of the gods. But that would be a wrong reading. That would be a misunderstanding. Mahakasapa's begging in the poorest part of town is an act of metta. It's an act of compassion. It means that the poorest, and traditionally the lowest, have the opportunity of contact, of communication, of darshan, as it's traditionally called, with an enlightened man, with a spiritual friend. The begging round in those days was not simply about being given food. It was a time of blessing and inspiration and contact between people and those, well, in this case, who were enlightened. We could read the event as meaning that Mahakasapa didn't really need ordinary physical food at that time. He could have easily stayed in his cave, sustained by meditation, nourished by higher states of consciousness. In a sense, perhaps that's what the devas symbolise. He probably would have been more comfortable staying there. It would have been easier. But Mahakasapa rejects the easy comforts of meditation and of dhyana, and out of metta and compassion, does the difficult thing. He goes to the weavers. He goes to the poor and needy to beg a little food. Perhaps after begging that food and eating in some quiet place, he would have taught them the Dhamma. He's not bothered by the state of his health and by the roughness and poverty around him. And the Buddha sees all this and is deeply stirred and deeply moved and inspired by the sight of Mahakasapa. And he lets forth an udana, who has no one else to support, who is unknown, who is tamed and established in the essence, in whom the cankers are destroyed, the taints spewed forth. He I call a shaman. In these words, he sums up, as it were, the essence of Mahakasapa. His life is stripped back to its essentials. He's unknown, in the sense he's not interested in fame or anything like that. He's concerned with the essence of life. He's destroyed all the cankers, all the defilements. In fact, they're spewed up, spewed forth. Confession. We talked about confession yesterday, and you know, Sangharakshita has pointed out that confession in its highest sense is like the vomiting up of all the roots of evil. True confession is really a wisdom, the expression of wisdom and insight, with all the roots of unskillfulness purged from the system. That's the enlightened man. And this simplicity of being, this sort of essential being, if you like, is expressed in metta, in compassion. Mahakasapa is completely free to serve others, those forsaken, those cast out. Remember, Dr. Ambedkar, in his own sort of thoughts and reflections on the Buddhist tradition, said that he believed that the Buddha started his Sangha of full-time bhikkhus, and that they, you know, that they had no money and simple, very simple life, so that they could serve the people. And again, I'm reminded here of Vanti, of Sangharakshita. Many years ago, in the late 1970s, I was in India when Lokamitra started things in Pune, our movement in India. Lokamitra lived a very simple life in those days, and so did I think I can say, when we were starting things. And it was a great privilege for me to see, to witness Lokamitra working for the Dharma, setting up our movement in India. And on one occasion, we met an old disciple of Bhante, a disciple of Bhante from the late 50s and early 60s. He knew Bhante when he was when they were both much younger men. And his name was Mr. Rupawate. And Mr. Rupawate had become quite a successful politician between Bhante, you know, after Bhante left India, quite successful in the state, Maharashtra state government. And he met with Lokamitra and me, and we had a cup of tea together, and he talked about Bhante coming to his district back in the late 1950s, early 60s. His district was a very, very poor part of Maharashtra, with very, very poor Buddhists. And he said Bhante was so inspiring. He would sleep anywhere, drink any water, eat any food. He was quite happy to travel by bullock cart or walk from village to village. Mr. Rupawate said he made no demands, no special demands on us at all. Didn't ask for any special diets or anything like that. He just came there to communicate the Dharma out of love for the people. And Mr. Rupawate had tears in his eyes and said, we had never seen anything like this. We'd never met anybody like this. So the simple life is there for a reason. Not only does it support spiritual practice for self, but it means that we're completely free to serve others by doing whatever we can to bring the Dharma to others. And people need the Dharma. This world needs the Dharma. Everywhere people, no matter how wealthy and privileged they might be, everywhere we will find people who are poor because they lack the Dharma. Sometimes people think that one should only be involved in communicating the Dharma if one has some kind of insight. But that won't do nowadays. Everybody training for ordination needs to be involved in being generous with the Dharma. You might not yet be ready to teach it, take classes, give talks and all the rest of it. That might not be the time for that yet. But you can all support those who are doing that work. You know, joining in class teams, in outreach groups especially, being a good friend to those who come along to classes, giving financial support, giving practical help. I know some of you are involved in that, but always think about how you could do more. There's always something that can be done. So there needs to be a strong element in your training for ordination that is involved in helping the Dharma reach out to others. Sometimes it can happen that men who've asked for ordination in a way can get a bit narrow. They go to their Mitra study group, they go for their going for refuge group, and that can result sometimes in people getting a bit self-preoccupied, which of course can be self-defeating. So there needs to be, as part of your training, an expansive, generous, outward-moving element to your practice. A strong sense of serving the Dharma by helping to bring the Dharmas to others. There's much to do here in this world. And certainly the impression one gets of the Buddha and the early Sangha was of something alive and electric. a sense of the Dharma spreading through India, affecting all kinds of people. And some of them were really rough and ready, you get the impression. I mean, it's quite important to note this. Not all of the people in the Buddha's time, but actually, probably none of them originally, they're not all sort of saints and sort of spiritual people. Some of them were really quite rough and ready characters. Another favourite sutta of mine is the Yasoja Sutta on page 39 of the Anand translation. And in this sutta, the disciple of the Buddha named Yasoja turns up with 500 of his own disciples at Anathapindika's park. So Yasoja's obviously, you know, gone out there, taken the Dharma out there, communicated the Dharma to people, and he's said, right, come on, lads. Probably not like that. Let's go and see our teacher, the Buddha. You know, so it's like, you know, perhaps some of you, you know, who've made some good Dharma friends saying, come on, let's go and see Bhante. I mean, I don't know how he'd get on with 500 these days. He'd probably be quite pleased, actually. So they all turn up at Anathapindika's park, Yasoja and these 500, where the Buddha is staying. And when they arrive, they make they're really noisy. They're a really noisy lot. They make a loud noise, a great noise, greeting the other bhikkhus. They're turning up and saying, "Ah, how you doing? Great to see you." Oh, really excited. That's the way I sort of visualise it. And they're sorting out where they're going to stay and where they're going to store things. They make an absolute racket. It's a bit like people arriving at the beginning of a big retreat, perhaps. The evening meal, there's all that excitement at meeting people, meeting old friends. And the Buddha, who of course loved silence and who was sitting quietly, heard this great racket and he said to Ananda, "Ananda, what is that noise? What is that row? It sounds like fishermen landing a catch of fish." You know, it didn't sound like a group of bhikkhus at all, a really rough, untrained group of people. So the Buddha asked Ananda to call Yasoja and his disciples over to him when he found out who they were. And when they'd all gathered, he said, "Bhikkhus, why were you so noisy? Why were you so loud? You were just like fishermen landing a catch of fish." And Yasoja replied that the 500 had come to see him, the Buddha, and the noise, the loud noise, was because they were exchanging greetings with people and they were organising their lodgings and so on. And the Buddha was then very direct. He just said, "Go away. Go away, bhikkhus. I dismiss you. You are not fit to stay with me." The Buddha could on occasion be like this. You know, this is the Vajra Guru aspect coming here of the Buddha, the no-nonsense guru, as Sangharakshita has described the Vajra Guru, the no-nonsense guru who doesn't, in a way, care what he does to you to wake you up. And the bhikkhus just accepted what the Buddha said, and they wandered off into another country, another area, the Vajis, the land of the Vajis, and they set themselves up by a great river. They set up leaf huts and got down to their rainy season retreat, because it's the time of the rainy season retreat. 3 months, 4 months of retreat. And Yasoja, their leader, their teacher, their preceptor, their Kalyanamitra, said to them all before the retreat, he said, "Friends, the Lord dismissed us out of compassion, wishing for our good, wishing to benefit us, being compassionate. Come, friends, let us abide so that the Lord will be pleased with our way of living." And all the other bhikkhus agreed with Yasoja. And we can imagine that they really worked on themselves, on their mindfulness, on their metta, on their speech, probably observing long periods of silence. In fact, the text says that they lived secluded, they lived in retreat, which doesn't mean, and seclusion doesn't just mean physically being secluded, but drawing their minds inwards, meditating deeply. They dwelt diligent, the word here is appamatta, vigilant, alert mindfulness, watchfulness, to develop the skillful and move away from the unskillful. And they were ardent. There's that word tapas again. They were blazing with energy, with spiritual heat. And they dwelt with resolve, with commitment. They really practiced together. And within that period of retreat, the text says, they attained enlightenment. They attained liberation. It's lovely. They didn't react to the Buddha when he told them to go. They didn't have any authority. Who did he think he is telling us to go? And we're like fishermen. None of that. No. Got to get to grips with myself. They had complete confidence in the Buddha's, in the Buddha, and also Yasoja, their teacher. They knew that they needed to work on themselves. And shortly after the rains, the Buddha is walking on tour, and he goes to Vaishali, the capital city of the Vajjayan country. And he became aware that something was going on in a particular direction. He said to Ananda, he said, Ananda, that direction is filled with light. That direction is radiant. It pleases me to consider that direction. That's the direction where those bhikkhus are staying, Ananda. So go to those bhikkhus, Ananda, and ask them to come and see me. So Ananda went there, and he delivered the message. And very soon those 500 bhikkhus, led by Yasoja, had gathered around the Buddha. Apparently this all happens magically. But anyway, that's a detail. It's night time. The Buddha sits in the great wood in the hall of the gabled house. That's something out of Lord of the Rings, isn't it? Sits in the great wood in the hall of the gabled house. And the Buddha, we're told, is sitting in the imperturbable samadhi. Sort of a Kshobhya-like samadhi. The imperturbable samadhi. And the bhikkhus gather around him in complete silence. The 500 bhikkhus led by Yasoja, they gather round in silence. In fact, they all just entered the imperturbable samadhi. They completely tuned in to the Buddha's state. So there is the Buddha and these 500 sitting utterly still, absorbed in complete silence. And Ananda, who's very courteous and considerate and concerned, goes to the Buddha during the different watches of the night. And he tells the Buddha that Yasoja and the bhikkhus have gathered and they need to be greeted. The Buddha remains silent. There is silence. And at last, at dawn, after Ananda has asked again, the Buddha slowly emerges from the imperturbable samadhi and he tells Ananda that he and all those bhikkhus had been dwelling all night long, sharing the same samadhi. There was no need for a greeting. There was no need for any words. They were all dwelling, imperturbable as mountains. So it's a lovely story how these rough and ready characters, you know, arrive in that wonderful state. It's not an unusual picture of the Buddha and his disciples dwelling in profoundest silence, dwelling in what's called the Aryan silence. The silence not just of the tongue, but the silence as well of thought. They are, of course, there inhabiting an entirely different consciousness. I think a consciousness that transcends self and other. You know, if you've transcended thoughts, well, you've transcended thoughts about yourself and others. And these are wonderful, splendid visions of spiritual community. The Buddha seated with his monks around him. Sometimes in the shrine room, particularly when there's less of us, we sit round in a circle round the Buddha here. And, you know, you can begin to get the feeling of what that Aryan silence might have been like. And sometimes, I'm pleased to say, I've experienced a deep and loving silence within our own Sangha. Very often, interestingly enough, it comes after rejoicings in one another. True rejoicings, where there's been, you know, really, really positive verbal communication with others. And you just get that very strong sense of the shared ideal, the shared path, the shared Dharma, and words drop away, and you can just sit there in a very deep and rich silence. And the communication then, of course, is much deeper than anything that you get with words. But what I like about this story of Yashoda and the 500 bhikkhus is that, I do get the impression they're lads, they're lively, they've got energy, yeah, they're noisy, but they're straightforward. They respond to the Buddha's rebuke and redirect their energy, which leads to enlightenment and a profound communion with the Buddha. And I want to start drawing this talk to a close on the topic of communication within the Sangha, within the spiritual community, something of which is of very great importance to us, as you all know. And I want to explore this topic by considering Sutta 2 of Chapter 6, page 84. The Buddha is in Sarvati again. He just emerged from seclusion, from meditation. And of course, you have to remember that the Buddha's meditation is completely natural. But he's just emerged from that, and it's evening. The sun is setting. It's a beautiful time of day in India, and the Buddha has sort of come out of his retreat, and he's just sort of sitting outside. And along comes the Buddha's old friend and disciple, King Pasenadi. It seems that the Buddha is sitting by the side of a path or a sort of highway, perhaps outside his retreat place. And King Pasenadi of Kosala, who, yes, is an old friend and disciple, comes along. He prostrates to the Buddha and sits down beside the Buddha. And as they're sitting there, six groups of seven ascetics passes by, six different groups made up of seven each. There were Jatila ascetics, there were Jain ascetics, there were naked ascetics, there were single garment ascetics, there were seven wanderers, and all of them, it said, had hairy bodies, long nails, you know, they hadn't cut their nails, hairy bodies, long hair, and they're carrying their things in a bundle on a shoulder pole, and they're rough looking, hairy, probably quite smelly and unkempt. But they really do look like, you know, lean, holy men. And Pasenadi leaned over to the Buddha and asked, "Bhante, could any one of these be among those in this world who are arahants or who have entered the path to arahantship?" So in other words, are they enlightened? Any one of these? Have they entered the stream? Do they have insight? For some people, this is a very important question. They want to know who has insight, who is enlightened, who has entered the stream. Yes, for some, it's a very important question. They really want to know who it is in the order who's got it. I remember some years ago, on a number of seminars with Bhante, each time someone asked the question, you know, about insight and who has it, what it would be like and all the rest of it, Bhante would often quote the story of three of his teachers, very, very great, outstanding Nyingmapa teachers. And the disciples, among those his Tibetan disciples, they wanted to know who was the most enlightened out of the three of them. So one of them sort of plucked up courage, went to one of these great teachers and said, "Is there one of you who is more enlightened than the other?" And the teacher said, "Yes, there is one of us who is more enlightened than the other. And you will never know who it is." I must say, about the sort of business to do with attainment and all the rest of it, I must say it's not something that's ever bothered me. For example, I've got absolutely no idea where Bhante stands, where Sangharakshita stands in terms of sort of spiritual attainment. Absolutely no idea at all whether he's a stream entrant or this or that. And frankly, I'm not interested. It seems to me a rather crude way of thinking. What I am, though, is completely confident that I'm part of a spiritual community in which the living stream and the living force of the Dharma is alive and accessible. I'm in a community where the Dharma ocean is available to enter. That I am confident in. But anyway, let's listen to how the Buddha responds to Pasenadi's question. Great King, being a layman, enjoying the pleasures of the senses, living at home with the encumbrance of children, making use of sandalwood perfume from Benares, wearing garland scents and unguents and handling gold and silver, it's difficult for you to know whether or not these are arhats or whether they have entered the path to arhatship. So this is the first thing the Buddha says. He's saying that it will be difficult for us to know somebody's real spiritual worth if we're involved in worldly life. Perhaps our version of this would be, it will be difficult to know someone's real spiritual quality if we're encumbered with family, career, mobile phones, computers, mortgages, televisions, going to the cinema, girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever it might be. So there's a very important message here from the Buddha. Sometimes it seems to me that people think that they can know someone's spiritual quality in the same way that they can know any kind of ordinary piece of information. I wonder if that's part of the sort of the arrogance of the sort of education that we have in the West and the sort of material, you know, achievements that we have in the West, that we think that we can be knowledgeable about these topics, about these deep, you know, higher spiritual topics, if you like. Because people have read books on Buddhism, because they meditate a bit, because they can talk even about insight and enlightenment, they think that they know what it is. Therefore, they will be able to know who has got it. But the spiritual quality of someone cannot be known in this way. Knowing anybody, in fact, even on an ordinary human level, involves spending a lot of time with somebody in all kinds of situations and circumstances. You have to know their heart, if you like, to really know another. And this is what the Buddha says next. He says, it is by living with a person that his virtue is to be known, great king. And then only after a long time, not after a short period, and only by considering it, not without consideration, and only by one who is wise, not by a fool. It is through friendship that a person's purity is to be known, and then only after a long time, and only by considering that, and only by one who is wise. It is in adversity that a person's spiritual strength is to be known, and then only after a long time, and only by considering it, and only by one who is wise. It is by deep discussion with a person that his wisdom is to be known, and then only after a long time, and only by considering that, and only by one who is wise, and not by a fool. So the Buddha is applying this to getting to know anybody. To get to know anybody, you need to spend a lot of time with them, preferably live with them, befriend them, see them in good times and bad times, see how they deal with adversity. You know, sometimes people say to me, oh, Padmavajra, you're so great, you know, you're so fantastic and all the rest of it, but I'm entirely dependent on my conditions. You don't know what I'd be like if Padmaloka, you know, went down the tubes or something like that, or something happened to me. How do I deal with adversity? You know, can you bring insight? Can you bring wisdom? Can you keep practicing the Dharma to that situation? And then you need to discuss with people to really know what they're like. You need to discuss deeply with them, not just sort of superficial Dharma discussion, but really finding out what their views are, how they see the world. And even then, with all these things, you need to reflect deeply on people. Reflect deeply on them with some wisdom. That's how you discover the quality of their virtue, their sila, their purity, their spiritual strength, and their wisdom. And this is why it can take some time for people to get ordained. I said the other day it can happen quickly, but it can take some time also. The order members who know you need to get to know you deeply. They need to really weigh your spiritual quality. They need to see it and resonate with it. And that's not easy, because trying to do this challenges the order member's own spiritual quality. When Subhuti first started to do ordinations, he was the first order member after Sangharaksha to do ordinations. You know, obviously it was a, you know, it was a very, very big development in the movement. He was sort of, in a way, in uncharted territory. And he reflected very deeply on what was going on when he witnessed another's going for refuge. And he made this very famous saying, "In witnessing another's going for refuge, my own is called into question." And Bhante was very taken with this. "In witnessing another's going for refuge, my own is called into question." You know, and he said it's actually true. That saying should be true for all order members involved in helping people to get ordained, involved in discussing the readiness of somebody's ordination. When you do that, you have to ask yourself, how well do I really know this person? Do I really see their spiritual qualities? And when you start asking that question, you have to start asking yourself, what is the state of my own going for refuge? How are my spiritual qualities? If I can't see that in them, what does that say about me? Discussing ordination requests is the most demanding and the most rewarding spiritual practice that I know. And it is a spiritual practice, because it's about seeing the spiritual quality of another and about being concerned for their spiritual welfare. And to witness it directly, you have to be confident. To witness it directly, you have to be confident not only in their own individual going for refuge, but you also need to be confident, well, are they going to be able to express that in the order? Are they going to be able to harmonise with all other order members? Are they going to be able to do it for the benefit of others outside of the order? And are they going to be able to go for refuge for the rest of their lives, whatever life throws up? That's the kind of question you have to ask when you're seeing whether or not somebody is ready for ordination. So I'm giving you a little insight into that. And it's why you really need to get to know order members well. Need to get to know the order well. I mean, you've got to check the order out as well. You know, we're talking about spiritual quality here. Well, you know, check out the order. Maybe you won't find the spiritual quality that the Buddha is talking about here. If it's not there, well, how can you commit yourself to it? If you've got reservations about it, go and find it somewhere else if it's not, you know, doing it for you. So this sort of approach to seeing somebody's spiritual quality is very, very different from the superficial way in which people make judgments about others, judgments about their qualities. And this sort of superficiality of judgment seems to bedevil our age. I think it's one of the big problems that go with, you know, for all the wonders of technology and sort of speed in a sense of communication, it does lead to extraordinary superficiality in terms of, you know, judging other people, to my mind. I mean, I think another quality about when the Buddha talks like this, of really knowing some somebody. It brings up for me, you know, sometimes we can be a bit sensationalist about who's got insight and all the rest of it. But what you're really looking for is real reliability in somebody. It's interesting we use this word refuge for the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But in the Sigalavada Sutta, where the Buddha is talking about the qualities of a true friend, he said a true friend is a refuge to the other. A true friend is a refuge. And Bhante, when he studied this sutta, said, well, that is really extraordinary. To be a true friend, you have to be absolutely reliable. Absolutely reliable. To be a true friend, you have to have real spiritual quality. So he said, he's put it like this, stream entry is a means to friendship. So perhaps, as well as thinking about insight and all that sort of thing, maybe you need to think, is somebody a refuge? Are they really reliable? I was talking to somebody yesterday who was saying that they love Surita. They love Surita because Surita, he said, is just there. He said, I've known him for years. I keep turning up here and he knows me and he's available. And he's just there and he's just the same. I'm not saying, by the way, Surita's a stream entrant. I don't know that. I don't care about that. But I know he is reliable. Anyway, if we want to know someone's real spiritual quality, then we need, ideally, to live with them, or certainly spend a lot of time with them. We need to befriend them and see them in all kinds of situations. We need to talk Dharma with them, share the Dharma life with them, well, for our whole lives. And then, just maybe, one day, we might have something to say about their quality. And I suspect that's something would be a heartfelt rejoicing in their life and how they enrich the world with their actions rather than sort of mention of levels of attainment or anything like that. After the Buddha had told the great King Pasenadi how to really get to know another, King Pasenadi said, it is wonderful, Bhante. It is marvellous, Bhante, how well this has been said by you. These ascetics, Bhante, are my men in disguise. They're informers, spies, who are returning after spying on the country. First they gather the information, and then they tell me what's going on in the country. Now, Bhante, when they've washed off the dust and mud, and are well bathed and perfumed, and have trimmed their hair and beards, and presumably cut their nails, and dressed themselves in white garments, they will be about to enjoy the five kinds of sense pleasure. So they're not holy men at all. I'm sure the Buddha knew that, but anyway. But the message is, don't go on appearance. Don't go on clothing or lack of it. And don't go on necessarily the words. You know, the sort of, you know, some people can use all sorts of spiritual words. You really need to get to know somebody over a long period of time. We need to get to know one another for there to be a living, vital spiritual community. The Buddha, of course, could know someone's real spiritual quality. He could even know when someone was enlightened and what state they were in after death. And I want to end this talk with the Buddha's communication with an enlightened disciple. I want to end as we began, actually. I think it's important that we end where we began. We end with enlightenment. I want to end, with the last two suttas of the Udana. Very strange suttas. With someone called Dabba of the Mullas. Dabba Mullaputta. Dabba, that's his name, who is a son of the Mulla clan. And there's a very interesting little backstory to Dabba. I sort of looked him up in the commentaries. He was born in a funeral pyre. His mother had died and she was cremated pregnant. But somehow, Dabba survived. You know, not a good start. Not a traumatic start. And he was raised by his grandmother. And at the age of 7, he saw the Buddha and immediately wanted to join the order. So his grandmother took him to be ordained. It's a very early example of the young people's movement. 7. And Dabba, at age 7, became an arahant in the ordination hall. You've got a 7-year-old arahant, which I'm sure would be quite something to be around. Anyway, he went off with the Buddha, this 7-year-old arahant, but decided that what he really wanted to do was to serve the order. That's what he wanted to do. So his main practice, he decided, was sorting out the sleeping quarters of travelling monks who came to stay and be on retreat with the Buddha and the great disciples. And not just sorting out their sleeping quarters, but showing them where to eat and that sort of thing. He was a sort of enlightened retreat organiser or guest master. And it's very striking that an arahant would express his enlightenment through such apparently humble service, through hospitality. And he performed his duties, it says, most diligently and with great intelligence. And in fact, his fame spread far and wide. Apparently, bhikkhus, this is lovely, would deliberately arrive late in the night and asked to stay at a remote place in the retreat place, because Dubba had this special skill of bursting into flame, and he'd walk ahead of them through the jungle with his finger burning to light the way. It's a really fabulous image. And someone, in fact, saw it and became a stream entrant just on seeing it. You might like to try this with Taradasa. Turn up really late, like 2 o'clock in the morning, and ask for a camping spot and see if Taradasa can light the way. I'm sure he could. It's a joke. He's giving me a look. Dubba, it seems, died young, and the last two suttas of the Udana describe his death, or rather, his parinibbana. The first sutta, Sutta 9 in Chapter 8, depicts the Buddha staying at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove at the squirrel's feeding place. And Dubba Mallaputta approached the Buddha, prostrated himself, sat down respectfully to one side, and he said, "Now, Sugata, it is time for my parinibbana." And the Buddha said, "Do what you think it the time for, Dubba." And Dubba Mallaputta rose from his seat, prostrated himself to the Buddha, and keeping his right side respectfully to the Buddha, rose up cross-legged into the air, into the sky. And while sitting there, he entered into the fire element. He became a mass of flame, a mass of fire, burning in the midst of space. And then he entered parinibbana, final, full and complete nirvana. And his body was burnt up, utterly consumed, so that neither ashes nor soot remained behind. And the Buddha was deeply inspired by this, and he breathes forth an udana. Broken is body, perceiving is dissolved, all feelings cooled, all mental activities calmed, and consciousness has reached its end. It's interesting to read Bhante's comments on this episode. He reads it as a description of spiritual death. Parinirvana is the complete dying away of the conditioned self. That is what is burned up. Self and other are burned up. Form and no form, existence and non-existence. All categories are completely consumed in the blazing fire of wisdom. And the Udana itself that the Buddha utters could sound a bit negative, sort of nihilistic. It could sound as if parinirvana is annihilation, but that would be a wrong interpretation. The Buddha is singing about the burning up of the conditioned being. And we're left to imagine the vast open space that the burning up takes place in. And in the last sutta of the Udana, we find the Buddha talking to the bhikkhus about Dubba Mallaputta's parinibbana. This happens sometime later, at Sarvati, perhaps the Buddha has been reflecting or meditating on what has happened. And he describes to the bhikkhus exactly what has happened. He said, Dabba, you know, rose up into the air after prostrating to me. He sat cross-legged in space and he was consumed by a blazing fire. He entered into the fire element and he was consumed completely so that there is just space. And the Buddha gives another Udana, the last of the collection, evoking the mystery of Parinibbana, the mystery of enlightenment, if you like, the mystery of spiritual rebirth that comes after spiritual death. And it's an unequivocally positive description. As well as evoking the mystery, it mentions the attainment of unshakable bliss. Just as the place of a blazing spark of fire struck from the anvil, gradually fading, cannot be known. Just so, there is no pointing to the place of those who are perfectly liberated, who have crossed the flood of being bound to sense desires and attained unshakable bliss.